like to welcome everybody that's on the panel and those that are joining us this morning for various reasons. So thank you all for being here. I'm going to try to get things going quickly here. And we're actually going to break the rules already. And after we'll go around, let's do the introductions, maybe a little bit about what brings you here this morning. And then we'll go off the agenda, and Director of Department of Agriculture is here this morning to talk about the latest bee incidents that have occurred. So we'll hear from Katie and then get back onto the regular agenda. So anyway, would you like to start?
Sure. Chuck Thompson from Hood River. Kind of a dual sword for me. I'm state senator currently and a pear grower, so very interested. It was a good fit for me to be put on the committee, and after the committee was assigned, George Hansen, who that's who we get all our pollen bees from in the spring. So great to see him on this.
In the daylight.
I'm Beth Petrino. I'm a committee staff here to help you do your work. And just a note, because I think there's been a question already, these mics are not projecting in the room. They're just recording the meeting. So everybody knows.
Hey, my name is Ramesh Sagili. I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Horticulture. I'm honeybee research and extension faculty. I think I got the most time to talk about pollinators here, so I'll be spending next 30 minutes, I guess, giving you an overview of pollinators, especially honeybees and native bees as well. So yeah, that's what I'm here for.
And what great university do you represent?
Oh yeah, JC. I have my name tag as well with OSU, so I'm at
OSU. Great.
Oregon State.
Okay.
Go Beavs.
We get a lot of U of O plugs, so I wanted to get that in there. Yeah.
Hi, my name is Christy Split, and I work for the Oregon League of Conservation Voters. And I'm looking forward to learning as much as possible and working together to find some solutions going forward.
I'm Jeff Stone, a University of Oregon graduate. Apparently that's a detriment. I'm with the Oregon Association of Nurseries. Nursery and greenhouse industries are the largest sector of agriculture. So we have landscapers, retailers, and growers, all part of our association.
I'm Richard Little. I'm retired. Mm-hmm. And before I get any further than that, I would like to let everybody in the room know that I do have a hearing loss. Okay, so I've told a few of you, if I act like I'm ignoring you, I am not. I assure you, I just may not realize you're speaking to me. So please bear with me. That being said, I'm retired. As I said, I've worked for the California Department of Food and Agriculture, and I retired as a Deputy Agriculture Commissioner. And now I'm a Master Gardener, so I'm representing that chair.
Thank you. I'm George Hansen. I'm a commercial beekeeper in the Willamette Valley, but that means so we move our bees up and down the West Coast, and I do have bees in Idaho and in North Dakota right now as well. Been doing that for almost, for 35 years, and I get involved in a lot of national politics. I'm the most recent president of the American Beekeeping Federation as well, so I've been involved in Farm Bill issues and EPA issues and in NRCS and USDA FSA issues. And so, and I am currently sitting on at least two other national boards that are doing a lot of the same things we're talking about here. So I have kind of a global perspective.
Thank you so much for being here.
I'm Betsy Earls from Associated Oregon Industries, which also has the Oregon Retail Council under our umbrella. And I'm here because the bill, as it started out last session, would have impacted retailers severely. So I wanted to bring that perspective to the table. And I'm looking forward to working with you all.
Scott Dahlman, I'm the Executive Director of Oregonians for Food and Shelter. We're a grassroots coalition representing farmers, foresters, and other pesticide users. So we have a lot at stake in this conversation, both in the pollinators needed to help us grow many of our foods and also keeping the tools available to control pests as well. So I look forward to the conversations that we have here.
My name is Amay Code, and I work at the Xerces Society for Invertebrate Conservation. I've got a little bit of a cold, sorry. And I and been working on pesticide-related issues for the last about 15 years, and the Xerces Society works with a lot of growers, and we really love working with conventional growers to find where is that sweet spot, where can we have conventional agriculture and still be protecting pollinators. So I'm very excited because I think that's really what we're doing in this room, finding that place where we can be sustainable and continue to have our tools. So good to be here.
Great. Thank you again for all of you for participating. We will be hearing from Katie in a minute. We will elect a chair and have to adopt rules. That's according to the bill language. Before we get too far into this, I just want to acknowledge that there have been some activities going on outside of this room, some communications, some opinion pieces that appeared in the news. And, you know, that's great. I'm all for free speech. But I want to point out that when we're in this room, that it's so critical that we continue to work together as we did as a stakeholder group. And not all of you were on the stakeholder group, but we did a great job of coming together and actually talking about what we could accomplish in this bill. So I think that, you know, you all realize that we're going to be judged on what we get done in this room. And so that stuff out there, that's fine. But when we're in this room, we need to be working together. And so I'll ask you to work together. I think we have a real opportunity to make a difference in this state, and I'm going to be optimistic, maybe in this country, on how we talk about and how we work with pesticides. But we can't do that if we're not working together. So let's put away the six guns and work together. In the education world, I'll go just a hair further. We take a couple of hours typically. If we're going to get together and have a big meeting, we spend about 2 hours because, believe it or not, teachers don't always agree on how to do things. And they go through a norming process, and they talk about, well, how are you going to run the meeting and how will everybody work together? And teachers are way too touchy-feely and everything for me, but and we don't have 2 hours to spend doing that. So I'm going to say some really obvious things that I'm pretty sure you would agree with me on, that that we need to work together and demonstrate respect. We need to participate in whatever way that would be appropriate, whether that be speaking up or bringing information, being on time, and I just lost my place because I had four things. There we go. One of the things I really like is this term is show the best or assume the best intentions, meaning that you just assume that that person really has the best interest of this group at heart, and it just really makes a difference on how we work together. And lastly, that we will rely on the facts. We'll rely on market data to make our decisions. So I hope you can agree with that. That's a great way to work together. And anyway, wanted to get that out there. So, any comments on any of that? Sound pretty radical? Yeah. All right. So before we get into the agenda, Katie Koba is here to give us an update on latest things in a.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning. I'm Katie Koba, Director of the Oregon Department of Agriculture. And I was just going to take a few minutes to bring everyone up to speed on the most recent events that we've been dealing with related to bumblebees and actions that we have taken. And I think some of these you'll want to put on your list for considerations for this group to think about moving forward. We all know that a year ago this month we had a very, very unfortunate situation with bumblebee die-offs. The most visible of those was in a parking lot in Wilsonville, where we had estimates of over 50,000 bumblebees that died. In the course of our investigation, we determined it was because of dinotefuran, which is a neonic that was applied to linden trees when those trees were in bloom, and pollinators, primarily bumblebees, then came to those trees and were killed. We also had some additional incidents happen similarly at the same time, all involving linden trees. And so we, in the course of our investigation, began to focus in on two neonicotinoid products, imidacloprid and dinotefuran, and their interaction with linden trees and the very negative consequences that has for pollinators and bumblebees. Last year, on the 27th of June, we issued a temporary rule banning the use of neonicotinoids on linden trees, and that was a six-month emergency rule. Gave us a chance to complete our investigation and then determine best next steps. When that rule expired, we then subsequently put in place a state label restriction on imidacloprid and dinotefuran, and that label restriction said you could not apply those two products to linden trees. We thought at that time that that was a very good step to take in order to prevent an incident like this from happening again. That went into place early this year, right in time as products were being re-registered, and the requirement was that that label statement be placed on any registration of those products. We received a call, or actually we did not receive a call. We read in the newspaper on June 17th of bee die-offs, just a couple weeks ago, of bee die-offs in Eugene, and immediately began investigating that incident, found out that it was an applicator that had had applied imidacloprid to linden trees in an apartment complex, about 17 trees, and there were bees dying at that time. Needless to say, that was a very frustrating experience for us, given all of the outreach and education that we had done, as well as others, about linden trees in particular and those two pesticide products. In contacting the applicator, he admitted immediately that he had made a mistake and that he had realized it at some point in time through his application and stopped at that time. So he immediately admitted he was not paying attention and had made a mistake. We issued a temporary suspension of his license and had some conditions in place before his license could be reinstated, and that was both the operator license as the company and the applicator license of the individual. In order to get that license reinstated, he needed to retake the licensing tests that were required, and in particular the tests focusing on preventing pollinator deaths. He needed to remedy as best he could the existing situation, and he worked with his company and friends in the area and was able to cover all of the linden trees the weekend following the incident. And then he needed to demonstrate to us with written materials that he had put policies and procedures in place and training for his staff so that this incident would not happen again. He completed all of those steps last Friday, and we reinstated his license late Friday afternoon. Our investigation around the case continues, and we will expect that there will be civil penalties issued in addition to the steps that have already been taken with this incident. A couple days later or so, 3 days later, we received word of bee die-offs in a Beaverton location, also associated with linden trees. Sent investigators out, and this was actually a gentleman who contacted us to indicate that he had done injection treatment, bark injection, with imidacloprid on linden trees in March and then in May, and that there were bees dying off at these trees, trying to remember the number, I think it's about 22 or so trees in this instance. He asked what he could do Because of the die-off, we immediately shared with him the ability to cover those linden trees, and he immediately moved and moved forward to cover those linden trees as well to prevent future die-offs. In our initial investigation of that situation, in looking at the product and the labels that he was using, they were old labels. And under the old label, that is a permitted use, the bark injection, because at the time the treatment occurred, the trees were not in bloom. We immediately became concerned about the old label issue and did a quick kind of market intelligence search, as quick as we could, to determine how much product was in the pipeline with old labels, and determined that indeed there was a lot of product in the pipeline with old labels. And even though we felt we had done a significant amount of outreach when we had put the state restriction in place, technically that's not a label violation if they're using the old label. So last week we immediately issued a temporary rule, just about exactly to the day of the temporary rule issued last year, that prevented any application of imidacloprid or dinutefuran on linden trees, period. The emergency rule exactly mirrors the state label restrictions that we put in place for new product earlier this year. So in hindsight, we would have done that sooner, but we didn't. That rule is in place. It's a temporary rule, so it would expire in 6 months. So this is probably something that you would want to put on your list in terms of how we deal with these two neonicotinoids and linden trees in the future. It seems to be so far that the issues that we have had are really focused around linden trees. Interestingly enough, and Ramesh, you may mirror some of these comments in your statements, we thought, why is this only seeming to happen in Oregon? And our plant program director did some research and determined that linden trees, which are native to Europe, grow only in certain climate zones, basically around coastal climates, which would include Western Oregon, Western Washington, California, on around. Bumblebees and the particular species that have been killed in these incidences seem to be native only to Oregon, Washington, and Northern California. So we are indeed somewhat isolated in this kind of collection between linden trees and bumblebees. Not heard of this happening in Washington, so I'm not exactly sure if they don't plant as many linden trees we have, or just what may or may not be happening in Washington, which could be another thing that we might want to look into. But so far, based on everything we've heard, this seems to be an isolated incident to Western Oregon. We've needless to say, been receiving quite a few calls about bumblebees or pollinator deaths. There's certainly a heightened awareness on this issue. We have investigated calls from four different hive owners over the last week and a half. There's been about 16 hives amongst these four different owners, not equally divided, and about five of those 16 hives have had complete die-off, basically around the Sandy Estacada area. We have had really great cooperation with the Oregon State Beekeepers Association, and Darren, I'm going to get his name right, Dewey Karen joined us on the investigation of those hives, and the beekeepers have volunteered to be a resource to us if we continue to get calls around particularly hive situations. Our initial look at those hives is inconclusive in terms of the reason for the die-off. And we have taken samples. It appears that the bees have starved, and that could be a combination of a number of things, disease, pesticides, and other things. So we have taken samples of those bees. we were looking for a lab that could maybe run a pesticide screen. One of the challenges that we have with this is we don't know what we're looking for on pesticides, so you have to run a pretty extensive screen. And our lab is not ideally set up to run that kind of a test. We've been trying to find a lab. We haven't had success yet. We're still looking, and it may be that we need to tie up our lab to run those tests, but we do intend to test those bee samples from the hives to determine if there was a pesticide involved or pesticides involved. So that's a quick summary of where we're at right now. We hope that the measures that we've put in place will prevent anything further this year. Obviously, linden blooms are in various stages, and hopefully we're at the downward end, although I think there's a gorgeous linden tree on the front steps of the Capitol that's just about ready to bloom.
You have hundreds of them.
Yes, I know. We have one very near our office, and they are beautiful trees.
I was going to say, too, they have aphids on them right now, and they're giving honeydew, so whoever's doing your landscaping,
yeah,
you might give them a heads up.
Except I went in my backyard. I have tulip trees, and they're covered in aphids, so I think it's just an aphid issue that we've got. But that is indeed why the trees are being sprayed at this time, and it's more than just linden trees that are being sprayed. So I think I'll stop there if there's any questions. We have Rose Cacciadorian with us in our pesticides program. She's on the agenda later this morning to give a presentation, and will be joining your task force on a regular basis.
Appreciate that.
I have a quick question. So in the examination of the hives, you're looking at nutrition, pesticide impact, potential pesticide, varroa mite.
Exactly.
All those potential causes that have been identified?
Okay. There seem to be initial signs of a combination of those things, and it's hard to say if pesticides weighed in on that or not. So,
imidacloprid is used on lots of woody plants, landscape, and I don't know, it's listed for cherries and probably pears as well, too, and often is used as a drench, so it becomes systemic, like a bark. They bloom at different times. Right now is a very active time for insects. But is there any reason to believe that this same application might not cause problems with other blooming trees or woody plants?
We have not seen any evidence of that. That was clearly one of the things that we were paying close attention to after last year's incident. And there's been some work going on with linden trees. I know a colleague of Ramesh's at OSU is doing some work around linden trees and neonics specifically. There's natural toxicity in linden trees anyway. We had an incident last year in Hillsboro where there were a number of linden trees sprayed, and there was only die-off under one of those, and that tree seemed to be diseased or stressed, which could have increased the toxicity in that tree. So there's a lot of questions around linden trees, and as I said, OSU, who's been a terrific partner for us, and will be moving forward, is doing some research around this issue. But so far, the incidences have been common in that they've involved either dinutafuran, imidacloprid, and linden trees.
I just have a couple of just fact questions that came to mind. So in the Eugene application, the product he was using at that time, it had the new labels on it? Or was he also an old label?
Old label, but the old label prevents applying to trees or to product in blooms.
Great.
And so that was a violation of the label. Okay. And he also admitted that he knew of the new label requirements, and he just should not have applied it.
And then can you remind me of the maximum civil penalties for these incidences?
In statute, our civil penalties are set for first-time violators. The maximum is $1,000 per count. I'm looking at Lauren to make sure I get this right. And for multiple violations, the maximum is $2,000 per count. And so the issue becomes how many counts in an incident, and then we have a matrix that determines the penalty.
And then were there any bees killed in Beaverton, or was it just the guy knew that he had screwed up and wanted to make sure that there weren't any bees?
There were bees killed, okay. Yes.
Great, thank you.
Okay.
just looking up. I was trying to remember the tree in Hillsboro. I believe it also, with the bees underneath that were dead, definitely stressed raising the issue. But I think they also had really high levels of pesticide under in that tree, the residues. And I can look it up. I don't know if you or Rose knows that also.
Yeah, that is correct. It had unusually high levels of dinotefuran in the flowers up to the and it's really unclear to us and even the registrant how those levels got that high. And so that's one of the reasons we're working with Oregon State University to try to figure out if a tree is stressed, what's going on within that tree could somehow stress a sequester of pesticide. Is that possible? And so we're just trying to learn about the movement of those pesticides.
Actually, the concentration of sugar is high when a plant is stressed, so we think probably that could also play a role. So if you're spraying something, it could be in more concentrations in those nectars if the plant is stressed. So plant physiology is very complex and still we need to understand. So we're trying to collaborate with some plant physiologists as well to see what makes a difference between a stressed plant versus a non-stressed plant. And there is this mannose-sugar issue. Some plants have more mannose in them than mannose is a complex sugar that bees can digest well. So there could be some association with mannose and pesticides as well. So there's so many issues, and this lindens are mostly studied in Europe. There has not been much studies in the United States. So this is a good example we can study here in our
place. I got a phone call last week, I think it was Friday, and from Department of Ag, I believe. And so I'm assuming you called every applicator.
Yes, thank you.
Commercial applicator, so
yes.
That was a pretty extensive.
Yes, so immediately following the incident.
It wasn't just a letter, it was a phone call.
Yes, incident in Eugene, we did what's called a robocall to all of our licensees, and I recorded that call and it went out, so that's why you got it. You're mm-hmm. obviously a licensee. We have board members that received it as well. We got very good feedback from that. A lot of people said that was great to get and a good way to outreach. We have followed up with a lot of new additions to our website. And then when we issued the temporary rule, we also did a second robocall notifying people of the temporary rule, and we will follow up with letters to all of our licensees as well. So we're trying to figure out ways to outreach that people get the message. And any suggestions that folks have, we rely on all of our various partners, Xerces Society, OFS, OAN, and others to help us get that word out, OSU as well. So we're trying to take advantage of as much outreach as we can, but we did get very positive feedback on the calls that we made.
I was curious with the Eugene case. Do you think the applicators, they understand what a linden is? Or I'm just curious because some people may not know how a linden looks like, and they may just spray.
He knew, and he said there, and it was true, there were multiple varieties of trees in the apartment complex and had told us the number of linden trees that he sprayed. So he knew of the mix of trees, which ones were lindens. But I think that's a good example. I don't think you can take for granted that people know what lindens look like.
I'm pretty sure there are more than 60-70% people, they don't know how a linden looks like.
And right.
So yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of education to be done in that area as well.
And
so
I think, did we put a picture on our web page? I'm looking at Rose.
We're developing some material.
Yeah.
And especially we're going to be serving at the Far West show. About linden trees and some of the issues that we're having. But we'll be posting that to our website also.
That's a good idea. We should probably be mailing out pictures or ways to identify what a linden tree is.
I'm not a good responsible source on this, but it seems to me that I've seen some pretty credible data on insecticide buildup in woody plants and trees that are given annual. This is especially showing up in landscape plants, and it may be just anecdote, but it seems to me that there's some pretty good information out there already that that there is this kind of a buildup that to toxic levels in blossoms when it's used systemically year after year.
Yeah,
I'm not an expert
but
on
physiology. But I would think that that's something we ought to find out.
Yeah, that you could tap into some people that are knowledgeable about that.
I think a question we need to definitely address at some point in our information sharing because of the long life of some of the chemicals. And how would somebody know? You know, do they keep a log that they've applied chemicals 1 year and then the next and so forth? So
certainly for our licensees that are licensed commercial applicators, they do have to keep records.
Yeah. Okay. Anything else? Thank you so much.
Thank
we appreciate
you.
All the work that you and your department are doing to
thank
help.
You. Good luck.
Thank you.
In your work.
Very much. Thanks.
Okay. All right. I think we are on to election of chair and adoption of rules. So I believe, Beth, do you handle this part? Or?
I can help you, but you could just move me through the process if you'd like to. I can talk about the rules at some point if you want that to happen.
By that, you mean we're supposed to do this?
Yeah, if people have questions about the rules, I'm happy to do that.
Well, I was surprised I didn't get to be chair, but I'm so. And I'm Senator Thompson. I don't even get to vote, so.
Anyway,
I honestly don't know what the process is. We just open the floor for nominations.
Yeah, you can you can do that. You can open the floor for nominations and just proceed like a typical someone nominates and then take a vote. Okay. So
we do need to elect a chair and open the floor for nominations.
You're looking at me.
I think I'm having a hand
or you could self-nominate.
Maybe I can make a motion to nominate. Is it Dr. Sahili?
Yeah, they can say Ramesh. Yeah.
Ramesh, okay. Ramesh to be the chair, if he's so willing, based on the dramatic hand gestures.
I'm really subtle. any other nominations? We have one nomination. Hearing none.
Second.
Thank you. All in favor of Ramesh to be chair, say aye.
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 Is he willing?
Yeah, you didn't have to be that quick. It doesn't matter. No, but I just want to make aware that this is the busiest time of research for me. I'm like totally crazy with my students and other things going on. And I mean, I know this is an important issue, but unfortunately this is a time when. So I would really appreciate, I mean, I'm willing to do this, but again, just remember that it's kind of a big endeavor for me because I need a lot of support from you guys. So probably maybe Representative Reardon can be still assisting everything, but I might be a informal chair. I don't know what you can call me, but
we will
but I will need a lot of assistance because even I talk to my department chair in case someone nominates, because I'm totally overwhelmed with too many things at this time. Probably I would have spent more time if this was in November, December, or January, but this is not the exact time. But I know this is an extremely important issue, so I would be glad to help. But again, I will need a lot of help from you guys as well.
Fortunately, we have excellent committee staff that will relieve the burden for both of us. And so hopefully we aren't adding a lot to your plate other than other work that you probably wouldn't be doing anyway. So we'll try to make it as easy on you as we can. Appreciate your stepping up.
Thank you very much.
So you're in charge.
Yeah.
Okay. You want to grab seats now?
Just in case.
I have to learn these things as well. I have never been on a task force before.
Just smack it as hard as you can.
Whenever you're feeling it.
Well, whenever I feel like, okay. That's easy then. I can do it, I guess.
Okay.
You want me to start?
Would you like me to just go over the rules quickly?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. So these are pretty boilerplate task force work group rules. I don't think there's anything even particularly to note about them. I did, since I emailed them out to you, make a couple just small tweaks in the language because I realized that there are some specific requirements in the bill that creates the task force when it comes to voting versus non-voting members. So the two legislators are the two non-voting members on the group. The rest of you are voting. So just to make the rules clear and to make sure that I caught that, In rule number 4 and 8, I specified that those apply to the voting members of the task force. So no big deal, I don't think, but just to make it consistent, I made those changes. So if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them. Otherwise, you can move forward with adoption of the rules.
Mr. Chair, I vote that we adopt the rules as amended by Beth for the rules of the task force.
Okay. Do I use this one now?
You may.
Okay.
So you can ask if there's any objections.
Yeah, any objections on what Scott and Jeff has proposed? Okay.
Without objection.
Okay.
Representative, did you want to talk now more about the context of the bill, or are you?
Just very briefly, because I mentioned it earlier, but there are a couple of new members on the panel, and I'll just kind of repeat a little bit about what I said earlier. But the reason we are here, I had a rather strong reaction to the bee die-offs last year, and I proposed a bill to ban neonicotinoids. And put them on a restricted use list, so that would basically ban them from homeowners and other folks. And quickly learned that that might not be politically viable. And so I did want to continue working on this, and was fortunate enough to be able to bring together Christy and Jeff and Scott and Omay and Lisa, sorry, and a couple other people that were on the group, and we had three meetings, stakeholder meetings. We had Oregon State people, we had Department of Agriculture, and from those discussions and a lot of emails and a lot of phone calls as well, we came up with the bill language that you have before you. And so I feel like it's a very strong position to be in, especially as I've learned more about the people that we have available to work on these issues, some that are in this room and some that are waiting in eager anticipation at other locations. But we have a real opportunity to have a very open, great discussion and come up with some better ways to really change people's perspectives about and improve people's awareness of how to deal with pests. And so I'm very optimistic about this, what we can do, and I like the way it got started, and very eager to get started. So we have two presentations today, and then when we get done with those, I have kind of a laundry list of ideas for where do we go from here, and talk a little bit about what the goals might be for this group. And you know, what we think we can accomplish in the time. But let's go ahead and jump into the initial presentations, and very happy to get started. So,
just a question.
Yeah.
I misplaced my copy of the actual bill, and I didn't see it was on the desk. Can we get some copies of that? Because there were some specific things we're supposed to do.
Does anyone else need a copy?
Yeah.
You?
I'll take one.
Yep. Maybe a couple more. Yeah.
I'll switch on maybe.
Okay.
I had it memorized earlier, didn't you?
If you want to, you can stand, or if you sit over there, you can run the computer. You're used to standing. Okay.
I teach a class at 3 days a week,
for an hour, so I'm used to it.
You need one black sock.
Let's turn
this towards you.
I don't think. Can you hear me, Bill, in the back? Yeah, except for. Okay. Do you want me to close?
No,
close
it's fine. No, it's fine. Just
yeah, because I have a nice English accent as well, so you need to be very careful when I say something. So what I'll do in the next 30, do I have 30 minutes, Beth? Or? Okay. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go over state of pollinators in Oregon, where I say state of pollinators, but again, it's very ambiguous. Pollinators, there are so many pollinators, like from bees to butterflies to bats and birds. So I'm a bee man, so I'm not going to talk much about bats, because I'm not a bat man. So we'll more focus on bees. I mean, again, I have honeybee specialization, so don't get me wrong if I'm not talking much about native bees. They're very important as well. But then because of my expertise, I might be more focusing on honeybees and a little bit on native bees as well as I get chance. So what I'll do is basically in this 30-minute talk is go over the different colony loss surveys that we have been doing with honeybees for the past 5-6 years since I have been here. And then I also will go over some honeybee diagnostic work that we have looked at pests and pathogens in honeybee colonies for the last few years. And then I will go over some of those prime factors that are responsible for colony losses that nationally or in Oregon we have been dealing with. So that's basically a nutshell of what I'll be doing in the next 30 minutes. So just wanted to start with, it looks like George can't see from there, so I'll step here. Just to give you an overview of how important bees are, I know we are all here because we recognize the importance of bees, but again, just to throw some numbers to show the importance here. So bees are very critical for our food security and functional ecosystem because we see a lot of crops that are being pollinated by bees. And then there are wild plants that are in the wild, which we don't pay much attention to, of course, are being pollinated as well. And so they're very important for our ecosystem as well. Sometimes we just get boiled down to these numbers with our economy, but then you have to see that how much they are doing for our ecosystem as well. So the value of bee pollination in the United States is about $20 billion. Again, I'm not talking about several other things that bees do, but this is just for the crops that they pollinate. And in Oregon, it's about $500 million worth of pollination that honeybees or all bees do here. And there are about 90 different crops that require bee pollination. That includes your seed, your fruits, vegetables, and nuts as well. And those who are curious on how many honeybee colonies we have in the United States, there are about 2.6 million hives. This is the latest statistics from NAS or USDA NAS, National Agricultural Statistical Services. And then coming to native bees, as I've said before, I'm not ignoring them, but I'm just trying to just emphasize more on honeybees being a bee researcher here, but they are extremely important as well. And so there are about 4,000 species of native bees in the United States, and about 900 here in the Pacific Northwest as well. And one statistic says one-third of our diet literally depends on bee pollination. And one more slide on importance of bees here. So just again to emphasize, I mean, we take bees for granted, and they have been taken for granted for a long time. And you see these top pictures, some of you might have already seen those. That's a situation in southwest China, where they don't have enough native pollinators to pollinate their pears and apples, and they are using humans to do this pollination work. So at least we are glad, or we should be fortunate that we are fortunate that we have bees here to pollinate our bee our fruits, vegetables, and nuts that we are so dependent on. And of course, as you know, we can't be efficient pollinators like bees, right? So I'll stop there for the introduction here, but let's go into the colony losses. So this is the numbers that I have here is from BIP. It stands for Bee Informed Partnership. It's a USDA program, basically based at University of Maryland. They're doing these surveys for the past few years. So since the colony collapse disorder started, you see this is 2006 and 7 until 2014 here. You might see, just don't get confused about blue or red line. Just treat this as one bar. I'll go back and tell you what these blue things are. But just see, they have been for the last 7 years, they have been hovering around 30%. And some years have been good. You see this 2011-12 probably was about 22%, and the last year has been close to that as well. So there are several factors. Again, these have been going back and forth, and again, I don't have time to go over those, but I'll be happy to answer questions at the end if you still have anything on these colony losses. So that's a big picture of the United States. Let's go into Oregon here. So I have been doing these surveys again with Dr. Dewey Curran. He's an emeritus professor, and then he has been doing his backyard surveys, and this is the survey that I have been directly involved with. So since 2009, I have been at OSU since 2009. So these are the numbers that we have been looking at. So you see, if you look at these averages here, about 22% colony losses have been documented in Oregon. When you compare it to the national loss, we are relatively better, actually. And there are several reasons, again, we can talk about those, why maybe we have good beekeepers like George Hansen. I don't know. So there are several reasons. I'm just joking here. But when you look at the backyard beekeepers here, the numbers have been relatively high. And there are several reasons. You can't literally compare these commercial beekeepers to backyard beekeepers because their management practices are totally different. Backyard beekeepers will not treat for their mites or several other things. So there might be several issues. And again, the way the commercial beekeepers report their losses are a little different than backyard beekeepers. So there are several different issues why we see this variation in numbers here. But again, just to give you a snapshot of the colony losses, we have been around 22% here. So as I mentioned before, we have been doing this honeybee health diagnostics. We have been looking at pest and pathogen levels in these honeybee colonies over, since 2009. This is a big picture of Oregon. It's not just few sets from the Willamette Valley or from eastern Oregon, but this is an entire picture of Oregon as a whole. So we have been looking at, again, some of you, these terms might be new, varroa, nosema, and fecal mites. I'll go over them in the next few slides, but for just one now, bear with me. Varroa mite is a pest. It's a notorious pest, and we'll go over those in the next few slides. So the prevalence is about 85% in 2009. It keeps fluctuating again. And so it's not an uncommon thing. Varroa mites are prevalent in the hives all the time. They're omnipresent. There is no country except for Australia where these varroa mites are not present at this time. So nosema, again, the prevalence has been high in 2009. Then you see a little bit fluctuation between these years. And then fecal mites are, again, another pest, which is a minor, it's categorized as a minor pest at this time. But fecal mites can be a problem in some years as well. So we still find those in the colonies in Oregon. And then viruses are very important. Unfortunately, it's a very expensive process to test for viruses. And in the United States, there are only a couple of labs that test for viruses. And so we sent some samples using that USDA AFIS program. And we found five different viruses in Oregon as well. Deformwing virus, this is called Israeli acute paralysis virus. Cashmere bee virus, this is a acute bee paralysis virus. And then this is called a Lake Sinai virus. So viruses are always critical for beekeepers. And these mites are always there transmitting these viruses. So they're very critical for colony survival. Coming back to factors that are implicated for colony declines, you might have heard of so many things, for funny things from cell phone theory to rapture to so many other factors. But at least at this point, I would say, bee researchers have a consensus that it's multifactorial and a complex problem. So in the next few slides, I'm going to go over each of those different factors that we think are very critical for colony declines. So I have just put all these different factors in here, but these three are the more critical ones, and I'll go over these as well a little bit. So parasites and diseases, I'll go in length a little bit more on these in the next few slides. Poor nutrition or malnutrition has also been cited as a major factor for colony declines. Again, remember that none of these single factors is causing the entire colony decline, but as I said before, it's multifactorial. There are several stresses that are stressing the immune system of the bee, and then that's the reason we see higher number of colony declines. So there is pesticides. Again, it has been a hot button issue, and I think we will focus more on that as well in these task force meetings. But again, I'll go over those in the next few slides. So pesticides, again, is one factor. Then miticides for varroa control. Beekeepers use some miticides in their hives as well to kill those mites. Otherwise, their beekeeping is not sustainable. You can't, as a commercial beekeeper, George or someone else, cannot have 100% or 50%, even 50% survival if they're not taking care of these mites called varroa mites. So they do use some miticides in the hives, and some studies have shown those can be lethal to the bees as well because they are interacting with other pesticides that come in. So I'll go over those as well in the next few slides. Then low genetic diversity. As we all know, honeybees are not native to North America. They were introduced into the U.S. around 1622. That's what the date is quoted usually. So we have only 6 or 7 subspecies of honeybees here in the United States. But whereas you look in Europe or Asia or any other part of the world, they have about 26 different subspecies. So our genetic diversity is low as well. The honeybees that we have here don't have a very good genetic diversity, and that is very critical for colony survival because there are several things. Again, I don't have time to go into those, but just giving you a snapshot. So the consensus is at this time all these different stress factors are acting or like a perfect storm, and they are compromising the immune system of the bee, and that's why we are seeing a significant colony decline. And again, I have to point out for sure is just don't think this is killing all your bees, because there could be some interactions between these two. There could be interactions between these two as well. So it's kind of a very complex picture. It's not just one thing. There are so many stresses Suppose you are having pests and parasites, and again, if you didn't have any pesticide load, probably your colony survival would have been better. But again, now you have these guys, you have this, you have this. So it's kind of so much of a complex thing, and social insects are so complex to explain, and again, their life cycle and so many things matter as well. So this is the guy I was talking about, the most notorious pest and very aptly named Varroa destructor. This has played a havoc to the beekeeping industry and the bees for the past 25 years. It was introduced into the United States in 1987, around that time, at least first detected. Probably it was introduced a little more earlier, but at least in 1987, the first detection of this mite happened. So it's an ectoparasite. It lives on the bees and has a reproduction inside the cells or the larva of the bees. So they transmit 4 or 5 different viruses as well. So it's not only sucking the blood of the bee, but also transmitting viruses, which can be a lethal blow to those bees. So I'll show you a picture of this virus problem. So you see, if you pay close attention, you see some bees have deformed wings, or they don't have even, this guy doesn't even have, looks like has any wings. So this is called deformed wing virus, and it's most prevalent when, and studies have shown it correlates with the mite populations. If you have high mite levels, you have deformed wing level virus as well. So mite control, as I said before, is very critical for the bee industry in the United States. It's just one example, but they carry several other viruses that I mentioned before as well. This is just, I thought, one of the slides I wanted to show you here is we do a lot of work with Varroa mites as well, and this is one from last year when we were taking samples of beekeepers when they were pollinating carrot seeds in Madras area. So the first week of July, you see the percentage. So this is percentage infestation of mites on the y-axis, and this is the time here. So you see the mite levels have been about 0.6%, but within a 3-week time, you see they have jumped almost twice the level. So the mite populations are very critical. They can jump within 3 weeks to a critical level where your colony cannot sustain. So these are some important things that are also affecting bees. So beekeepers have to be very vigilant, and that's why beekeeping is not fun at this time. I mean, ask any beekeeper. They were a lot better off 30 years ago before the mites came in, but today it's a challenge to keep those bees alive. And again, when I talked about those 30% losses, I should also mention for some of you, probably it might be surprising, because I still get that kind of a question. They say, okay, so we are losing 30% bees every year, so within 3 or 4 years we should have 0 bees, right? Technically, if we talk about percentages here. But it's not the case, because the beekeepers are building those lost hives back. If suppose George Hansen loses 500 hives this year, so what they do is they have these big hives with 50, 60,000 bees. So they can split, they can steal some frames of bees and brood and buy a new queen, again, pay another $30 for it. So it's coming at an expense. Don't think it's an easy thing. It needs a lot of labor, so a lot of expenses in feeding and keeping those hives back to getting those to the same level as they were. So there is a time going on as well. There is a lot of expense with queens and labor. So that's the reason why we still see this beekeeping industry struggling, because of the losses. It's not just that they're very easily able to accommodate that. Because if we are into a sheep or a cattle business, probably losing a cattle with a 4 or 5 year old, you can't replace it. But at least being an insect, they have an advantage that the life cycle is shorter, so they can replace those hives a little earlier than we can with other organisms. Nosema is another disease. I will not spend much time on this either. So Nosema apis and Nosema serrana, this is a gut parasite, lives in the guts of the bees and causes a lot of problems. You see this one is diarrhea. So the bees can get out and just defecate outside the hive, just barely on in front of the hive. So this new species has been prevalent for last 10 or 15 years, I would say, and we still don't know the epidemiology or phenology of this new parasite, or relatively new parasite. So some of the studies we are focusing at OSU are looking at phenology and epidemiology of Nosema as well. The next thing I talked about, poor nutrition in that slide, right? So bee nutrition is very critical. I still say bee nutrition is the first line of defense. If you can still keep your bees in a good nutritional status, they can still take some sort of stress, or maybe at least some level of stress. But again, with all the monocultures that we have and the hybrid crops that we are growing today, and then lots of habitat for bees, this all has restricted the bee diet, not only for honeybees, even for native bees that you see. There's a loss of habitat that has happened for the last 20, 30 years. So we are still struggling with those. So bee nutrition is very critical, and I would say if this is an added stress on your bees, then probably you'll have higher declines as well. Again, to show you some research, I'm just plugging in some slides here to show you how important the nutrition part is. So this is, again, hybrid carrots where beekeepers go and pollinate and see how much of a difference nutrition can make. So that part of Central Oregon is a part where you don't have much diversity and not much crops that are useful for bees. So what happens here is you see this is a group of bees or from beekeepers that we looked at. So these are same colonies. The dark bar and the lighter bar here you see are from the same group of bees, but they were fed protein during that time when they were there between July 9th and 26th year. And then these are the bees that were not fed any protein supplement. You see there is a drop of about 9% higher of protein level. So this is protein again. It's, again, it'll take a long time to explain me what protein analysis we do. But just for now, remember this HPG means hypopharyngeal gland protein, which is a protein in the glands of the bees that we dissect to look at the nutritional status of the bee. So that's one way we can look at whether your hive is nutritionally well or not. So you can see the nutritional drop is significant when you're not feeding them protein supplements. So this was one study that we did. And of course, now beekeepers do feed them, feed those hives with protein supplement to get them back to their status. Because that's the time of the year when if the nutrition part is ignored, then there is a good chance that your colonies will not be good enough to go for pollinating almonds in the winter, in the month of January or February. And it's come to pesticides, which is again the most contentious issue, I would say, at this time. So I'll try to give you some facts here, what we know from research and literature that is available. So pesticides have received significant attention. I don't know if you can see the slides well. I apologize if you can't see in the back. Some of the fonts are a different color here. So pesticides have received significant attention since the reporting of CCD. I'm not saying pesticides have just become a problem in the last few years. Pesticides have always been a problem with bees. But the only thing is they got more attention since 2006 or 7 when CCD or colony collapse disorder started. So a broad survey, this is an important study. That's why I'm citing here Mullin et al. From Penn State. This is a study when they showed that they took samples across 23 different states and they found about 121 different pesticides in the comb. The honeycomb, they were looking at pollen, they were looking at nectar as well. So the most important thing here is the additive. I'm not saying all these 121 different pesticides and their byproducts are hurting bees, but it's a very complex situation. There could be interactions, small quantities getting from different places. They can have these additive and synergistic effects. And the extremely important part we should understand is the wax comb. So most of these pesticides, I would say 90% of them are lipophilic. So lipophilic means they can dissolve in lipids. So your wax is a medium where they can get in and they can stay for a long time. So some samples we have tested for like 10 years old sample and the beekeeper, neither the farmer has used that pesticide for 10 years, but you can still detect some small concentrations of those pesticides in the wax comb. So this wax comb is the pain here. So this is the one, unfortunately bees can't survive without that comb. That's their home. And most of these pesticides, the nature is lipophilic, so they can get into the wax comb and stay there for a while. So again, these have not been studied well. No one knows what those interactions are. Or again, it's not just the pesticides. Even the miticides that beekeepers use as well, they also stay in the hive for a long time. So in commercial agriculture, pollinator protection and crop protection are not mutually exclusive. I know we all understand that. Both are important. Beekeepers have to protect their bees, and the farmer has to protect his or her crop as well. So these are not mutually exclusive, but we should have a balanced discussion on what can be achieved and still protect bees from the lethal exposures. Beekeepers in general, I think, have very good rapport with my experience here in Oregon. They have very good communication with their growers and whoever they're renting bees. But again, talking to some beekeepers, I realized that this rapport system is not so well with growers that don't need bees. But I'm saying, like, if someone is growing Christmas trees or maybe some other things, they may not be as aware what they are spraying because they are aware of, they may not be even understanding. That's what I was asking Katie, whether they can identify a linden. Because sometimes the perception is, okay, this is my crop, I spray here. Because bees are not foraging. They are not supposed to forage on Christmas trees. But unfortunately, Christmas trees get aphids. And when you spray for aphids, a Lord's ban or something like that, bees are going to still get some of that from there. So it's a very complex world we are living with. With bees foraging in a 27 square mile radius, it's very hard. So if there is a way, I know it's practically sometimes impossible, but if there is a way If the growers that don't need bees, they can do something as well, some protective measures where they are more aware that bees are around in this area, so we should be careful about it. So pesticide topic, as again I said, it's a contentious one, and there's a lot of debate both on both sides, and it's hard to focus on one area and look at. So I would suggest having a comprehensive discussion rather than just focusing on neonicotinoids. For those of you have not heard of neonics, but Katie was explaining as well. So neonicotinoids are a new class of, relatively new class. They have been here since 1995, I would say. But those insecticides are the focus that I see. But there are several insecticides that are very toxic to bees, not just neonicotinoids. But I see the discussion is mostly on neonicotinoids, which probably is a good thing. But again, I think we should look at it as a comprehensive, it should be a more broader look on all insecticides, not just neonicotinoids at this time. And a little bit on neonicotinoids here. As we all know, they are highly toxic to bees, and most prevalent or most widely used ones, I would say 25% of the all insecticides that we use in the United States probably fall under that class of insecticides called neonicotinoids. And this is, I had to struggle to make a statement here to see, because being a researcher, I have to give you facts, and so that's why I'm trying to see, based on the literature or whatever is available. So I would say, I'll read the statement here. So there are not enough studies to conclusively substantiate the role of neonicotinoids in colony declines, but there is enough evidence that warrants a closer look at these class of insecticides and encourage caution in their use. And again, I know this is just because we don't have enough studies at this time. I would say in 2 years probably we'll have more studies that have shown something either this way or that way, but at this time there is no conclusive evidence at this time to show that neonicotinoids are the only culprits that are responsible for colony declines. And most of the studies that we have seen are sublethal effects have been shown on foraging behavior, learning, memory, all these different things that are very critical for bees, like even the homing abilities. I think there was a study from UK looking at bumblebees actually, that their homing abilities were compromised when they were exposed to these neonicotinoids. So there is some evidence coming out at this time, but again, there is not enough at this time to really say that neonicotinoids will be causing all the colony declines that we see today. And the most challenging thing is the realistic exposure of bees to neonicotinoids. This has been a big, big problem. As a researcher, even I struggle. So recently, one of my students just started a study to look at imidacloprid, which was discussed earlier here, and chlorothalonil, which is a fungicide, a very widely used fungicide. So we are looking at interactions of those two. And it was a challenge. I think Louisa is here in the audience, and she is a toxicologist, and we were taking her help as well to see what is the realistic exposure. When we read the literature, there is not enough. So the field concentrations, the realistic field concentrations are hard to figure out at this time. Because we have seen studies that have been done in the lab with higher concentrations. There are some that have been done with lower concentrations. So there is, the science is all over the place. So it's kind of hard at this time to really pinpoint what is the realistic exposure. So we had to struggle, look at 20 different publications to find out a reasonable level that we can use for testing these insecticides. So again, this is a challenge, and as we discussed, we should also keep this in mind that realistic exposure is a challenge for looking at in terms of neonicotinoids affecting bees. Because in the literature, we see about 1 to 20 parts per billion. So those are very small concentrations. But then the other thing we are missing here is neonics can stay in the plants for a long time. That has been shown. So we don't know the repeated exposure. So looking at this realistic exposure is a challenge itself. And then how do you assess whether this bee is coming to the same plant like 10 times in a day or 20 times in a day? So we don't know those repeated exposures of these neonics. That's what I'm saying. Neonics are, they should be a part of the problem. They should be taken seriously and have to be studied well. But again, this poses a real challenge for bee researchers or any toxicologist to figure out what is the realistic exposure of these bees to neonicotinoids. So that's my part, and I asked Sujaya Rao, I think you heard her name before, when Katie was mentioning, she works with bumblebees at OSU. So I wanted to give a little bit on status on native bees as well. And the one thing I forgot when I talked about beekeepers having a general good relationship with communication with growers. So this is again a part I wanted to mention about native bees, because beekeepers have some say. They can move their hives if, I know that's impractical, it's not possible, but sometimes beekeepers have some say. They can know what is being sprayed, The grower can tell them what's being sprayed and when they should be spraying, if the bees are gone or not. But then there are native bees that mostly is the solitary bees that live underground, maybe in a rat hole or a mice hole or somewhere. Those are the bees that we never think about, actually, because we don't know where they are. And so a farmer starts spraying, and then what about those bees? The beekeeper has moved his bees or her bees, but then you have these native bees that are stuck in the vicinity. So those are also, we should think of those pollinators as well, because they are critical to our ecosystem and pollination too. So what Sujaya has given me this slide says she also, again, honeybees have problems. It's same with bumblebees and other native bees as well. They are also going through this decline. And she has cited three different things for the declines, the global declines at least for native bee populations. Is agricultural intensification. Again, it results in foraging resources, lack of those, then lack of nesting sites. Then they have their own pathogens like honeybees I showed you. So they have different pathogens, but again, they do have their own problems. And of course, pesticides, again, not much studies have been done with regards to native bees and their effects on. But again, the encouraging thing, what she says, at least with her work for the last few years in the Willamette Valley, she thinks the bumblebees are performing actually okay or well, because we have a very diverse cropping system. You see, we have from blueberries to cranberries to clover. So they bloom at different times, and so they have a continuous stream of sources or food sources for those native bees. So according to her experience, she thinks bumblebees are performing well because they have a good habitat or good nutrition from these different crops that we have around in the valley. And one thing she also mentions is the grass seed fields. We usually think grass seeds probably are not so useful for bees, but she has seen that the wool burrows that we see in these grass seed fields are very good nesting sites for these bumblebees and many other native bees as well. So there are some good things in the valley as well that are going on with our cropping systems itself. And then, of course, pathogens have been a concern for native bees as well. This is one example, Bombus occidentalis. This was a species which was predominant in coastal Oregon, but then you don't see much of these today. And there could be several reasons, but what she has cited is some pathogens that were picked up while this species was reared here in the in this part. And so the Midwest rearing facilities, they had this pathogen, I think, then they caught spilled over to Oregon and then probably to this Bombus occidentalis. And that's why we don't see this species quite often, at least in the coastal range of Oregon. So they do have very similar problems like what we have with honeybees. So I think I'll stop here and take questions if you guys have some.
Just, you seem to have a lot of information about commercial and agricultural applications, and you talked about the difficulty of realistic exposure as understanding all of that. Is anyone looking at what's really happening in backyards with the home gardeners, and are we able to collect any data on that?
Yeah. No, that's an excellent question, and unfortunately we don't have any information on the backyard use of these neonicotinoids or any pesticide at this point. So that would be another area probably we should focus some more research on, looking at how that's going to affect bumblebee populations or any native bee populations, including bees as well.
So when I go to Al's or another nursery, sometimes I see carpenter bees for sale, or they sell the little wood thing, you know, that's like a pseudo natural home for the. I mean, where do those guys fit into the spectrum of pollinators?
Yeah, so I think you're referring to mason bees.
Yes, that's it.
So mason bees are popular as well. Again, these are short-lived. They don't live like honeybees, like for the entire year cycle. But they're very important as well. But their foraging distance is also very close by. They don't go like 3 or 4 miles like honeybees. But they are excellent pollinators for some crops like apples, and you can use those. And so I see them. But again, so your question was, what do we know about their status? Or,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. So at this point, these are commercially reared ones that you get in those tubes and then you buy them from a store.
Mm-hmm.
And so they are reared somewhere else. They may not be even done in Oregon. So those are important. But then we, again, as I think Rich was saying, he has worked with some mason bees as well. So we don't have much information on mason bees at this time, and probably Xerces, I don't know, Amaya may talk about a little bit about mason bees if you guys are looking at any of those aspects.
Definitely there's a real lack of information on almost all of our solitary bees, like the mason bees, and what their status is in Oregon. Is really, we don't have a baseline from a long time ago compared to now. I know there was recent research on bumblebees, and a third of North American bumblebees are now at potential for extinction. So we're significant, and that was done by the International Union of Conservation Scientists. I'll have to look it up for sure. And bumblebees, of course, being colony bees, small colonies compared to honeybees, but then a lot of these others are solitary bees, and so they're pretty different, and there's really a real dearth of information.
Do we have any numbers at all on bee populations in general? I mean, you talked a lot about losses and all of that, but I mean,
like a baseline
nationally and statewide, either or, about where our overall population is.
Yeah, that's an excellent question what Scott is asking. So we don't have baseline for at least the native bees. No one knows. I mean, in Oregon, if you ask me 10 years or 20 years before, what was the status, how many? I mean, like Xerces has some information on the species that they're not seeing at this time. But overall abundance and those kind of things, probably no one has really looked at. They have not been, I mean, honeybees are the most studied insects, I would say. But for honeybees, yeah, we do. We do have numbers, but again, the numbers that I was showing you, 30% each year, because beekeepers are replacing those, so we have those. So like if you ask me what was the number in 1950 or 40, we had more hives. We had about 4.5 million. But then it's not just because of pathogens or pesticides. They have declined. They have declined because of beekeeping not being very productive, not being very remunerative, or beekeepers didn't make much money at that time with those problems they have. And then varroa mite came in. That kind of declined many of those hives as well. So there are several factors why we see that decline from 1940s to now. There are several factors I can cite. But honeybees, yeah, we can say that those are the baselines that we have that we compare. And again, the numbers that you get from 50s or 60s, these are from, again, NAS, the National Agricultural Statistical Services. So those people were looking at honey production hives. They were never focused on pollinating hives. So the numbers could, it's very murky if I start comparing 1940 versus 2014 numbers, because their focus was different in 1940s or 50s, how they were taking these numbers. But at least I think United States is the only country where you have some sense on honeybee populations, how they were there, at least the managed hives. The feral hives, we think the wild hives were wiped out after mites came in, like 95% of them were gone. So those are some murky numbers that we have at this time for bee populations. Yeah, am I?
Well, kind of to start, one of the things I understand also about why it's so hard to know the actual exposure dose to bees, especially colony bees, is because they might store their food as well. So we're looking at, you know, it's all the things that you mentioned, but it's not like, okay, I know there's 6 parts per billion that causes problem with this chemical. I know that this is the amount they were exposed to over, even if you try to do over time, we don't know what they store in their hive. And that's been also for me, it's like it's apples to oranges. It's not like, and then, but solitary bees, it seems like it would be, although we don't have the data, it's going to be a little bit more straightforward. Or maybe not. I don't know.
Yeah, these are two complex issues. Like what Amai is asking is about the foraging behavior is different between a solitary bee versus honeybees. And so honeybees live in groups. They store probably 100 or 150 pounds of honey whenever you open a hive, you'll see, at least in spring and summer. That's why we don't see, when people do these studies in cages in the lab, you see an effect. But then when you see in the realistic field situation where bees are bringing in a lot of nectar from different resources, if they're mixing it with several different resources, probably you don't see that. It's diluted. But suppose you are exposing your bees to just that, just for example, because neonicotinoids are in news, I will take that example. So if it's a dinotefuran and you just have this bunch of plants or trees that are sprayed on, and that's the only source they are getting, then I would say it could be lethal to those bees. But as a big picture, when you see 80,000 or 60,000 bees that are foraging, so there could be a dilution factor as well. But as you said, that's an excellent point, that solitary bees exposure could be totally different. They might get more probably, because that's a one-time consumption. They are just eating, right? There is no dilution. There is no enzymatic degradation of things, because bees put enzymes into the honey as well. So who knows? That could also change the process. Maybe those insecticides are degrading inside the in honey. But whereas for solitary bees, yeah, that's a one-time consumption. So that's why even the linden trees, I'm sometimes surprised that you see more bumblebees dead on those linden trees than honeybees, is because the behavior itself. Okay. Because honeybees already store a little bit before they go for flight. If suppose I'm a bee and I have to go 3 miles to forage, I already engorge on a little bit honey to travel there. But bumblebees, they don't forage that long sometimes, so they will just go to that linden tree here. So they just eat that directly into their system. So they are not even processing sometimes. So that could be more lethal for those bumblebees when compared to honeybees. So the biology and foraging behavior, these are very critical when we look at. So each insect should be looked as. So I don't think whatever is toxic to honeybees should be toxic to solitary bees or solitary bees to honeybees. So they're so different, so they should be treated differently as well.
Do you want to talk about this?
Yeah. So, George is reminding me about this. So this is an extension publication that we came out. Louisa is there in the back. She's one of the authors in this. And so this is an important publication. I mean, if we talk about how to reduce bee poisoning, there is a nice table in there where you can very easily look for your insecticide that I think beekeepers use this. They always give their farmers this copy. I think I have seen many beekeepers doing this so that they can look at this thing and see what insecticide they're using. So there's a red, orange, or a yellow, green bar here. So it tells the toxicity level, and then we have listed the product names here, the trade names if they want to figure out those. And there is an index at the back. It's easy to figure out. You can go there. Even with the trade name, you can go back here into the active ingredient and then see what is it. And then we have tried to put residual toxicity levels as well on this. And again, getting residual toxicity levels is kind of a big pain. Not all labels will have those. And EPA recently released that. Am I right, Louisa? I think Louisa can say something about that as well.
They did release a list of residual toxicities, but I think it's limited as to the products that they have residual toxicities for. And pesticides do vary by product.
So it's available on Extension website. You can just Google for PNW591 and you'll find this thing. So I think it's a most extensive and widely used one. I get calls from even California beekeepers that they really want these copies if we can send them. So please try to focus on these as well if some of you want to give it to beekeepers or to your stakeholders. So this is an important document. Yeah. Thanks for reminding, George. Any other questions?
Well, there are limits to what this says,
yeah.
Though.
Mm-hmm.
So this is basically based on label information, a little bit of anecdotal, but not much. So things that are not involved in label registration, like sublethal issues or mm-hmm. brood issues or other novel issues, yeah. anti-feed in behavior or other things, are not in here.
Yeah. So this is basically, we got all the information from the label itself, and then Louisa and myself have tried to dig into some research that is available in forms of publications. So we have used that, and so we put some question marks where there is some ambiguity, and still EPA has to do all those things. I mean, we as researchers can't test literally each product. There are like thousands and thousands of products. So residual toxicity is a very critical information. I think, I don't know how much attention farmers or the pesticide applicators pay for the residual toxicity. They may say, okay, this is toxic to bees or something. They might look for that. But residual toxicity is very important. I mean, you can't just allow the bees to go in next day or next day to forage on those. So that's, again, a very critical information that is absent. And even for growers or applicators, it's not available for them very easily. So we cite some of that in this publication. But again, as George said, it's not very extensive. You can't find all the sublethal effects or residual toxicities in this. But this is the best possible extension publication at this time.
And new materials haven't been updated.
I'm not chair, but if I was chair,
yeah, I should
go
you,
ahead
right?
and get on to the next presentation,
yeah, sure.
because I want to try to get you out of here at
I'm under training,
on time.
So. Okay, so I'll stop here, and probably where is Rose? Maybe she went.
Well,
there she is.
You know, I guess I'll leave it to the task force. Director Katie Kolba took up some of the time, and I had discussed that with her. And I know you don't have a lot of time left. Do you want me to give my presentation?
Can you do a
today?
10 or 15 minute version?
Yeah, I can do that.
Yeah.
I was originally set to talk about registrations and licensing, but I'm just going to talk a bit about registrations just because of the time situation. So I just want to start out as far as what pesticides are. A lot of times we get the impression that people think that they're just insecticides. We consider them, and EPA considers them, basically any substance that is used to prevent, destroy, or repel, or mitigate a pest. And so that would include herbicides, insecticides, fungicides, rodenticides, even plant-incorporated pesticides like BT corn, disinfectants, fumigants, etc. So a little bit about EPA. They were established in 1970, and what they do is they register pesticides for use, prescribe labeling, and other regulatory requirements. They also establish tolerances, which I won't be talking about. But really their goal is to prevent unreasonable adverse effects on health and the environment. I think we've come a long way in that. I won't go into that just because of the time. In order to get a pesticide registered, registrants are required to either cite data or provide data to EPA that will demonstrate that there will not be adverse effects. And there is millions and millions of dollars worth of data that they need to submit to EPA, whether it's based on residue chemistry, environmental fate. I won't go through the whole list. But one of them is on non-target insects. Recently, in fact, June 19th, EPA released a guidance for assessing pesticide risks to bees, and we do have a link to this from our website. It is fairly technical. It's over 50 pages long. But they are looking at non-systemic foliar applications, also foliar applications from systemic pesticides, seed treatments using systemic pesticides, because these have been implicated in a number of incidents, and also soil applications. They will be looking at drenches and also tree injections. And one of the things that they have in this guidance, and it's just a small mention, it's something that we've mentioned to them, something that George brought up. In fact, I brought it up to EPA after talking with George, is basically how long are these products lasting in trees, and when, especially when you're having yearly applications. That's something that we discussed with EPA dealing with the Hillsborough case, because those trees had been repeated more than they were treated the previous year. We don't have all the year's records, but they weren't only treated that one year with dinotefuran. So the types of pesticide registrations we have, and this is under FIFRA, the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, Rodenticide Act, is we have Section 3 registrations, and I'll go very briefly through these. Also Section 24C, we have supplemental labels, and Section 18, emergency exemptions. I think most of the time when we're thinking of a pesticide registration, we're thinking of Section 3 of FIFRA. This is the primary product label. This is what's registered by EPA, and it's also the base label for all state registrations. There could be several versions of a Section 3 out in the marketplace at any one time. We're constantly getting revised labels. If you were to come to our office, you would see stacks of labels. And and the applicator is actually required to use the label that's on their container. They can't look at a website and say, well, I like that label better. They have to use the one on the container, which we're seeing as a little problematic with this particular situation, where we had the registrants change their labels, but it could take quite a while for those labels actually to turn up in the marketplace. So at any one time, there could be several versions of this Section 3 label out in the marketplace. Also, sometimes the market label, the label you would see at a, let's say, a pesticide dealership or a retail home store, might vary from the EPA label. Let's say the EPA label has 20 different uses. There might be several distributor registrants out there that take just pieces of those labels. And so it's quite a diversity that we would see out in the marketplace. I mentioned Section 24C labels. These are special local need labels. These are labels that we grant, actually, at the Oregon Department of Agriculture. We require a data packet before we grant these. We actually have, I don't want to say more than any other state, but we certainly have a lot of them, and many of them, over half of them, are for use on seed crops, because we have a very large seed crop industry. And each one of these are unique. Now, there's also something called Section 18. These are emergency, what we call exemptions from registrations. These are something that the state of Oregon puts together a data packet, usually working with Oregon State University or another entity, not the pesticide registrant, though. And we submit a data packet and a request to EPA citing that there would be significant economic loss unless this emergency exemption is granted. We use something like this if, let's say, we have an existing crop, but there is some new pest that comes, and there is nothing to control it that's labeled. And the growers are going to be having 30-40% loss. Then we make a request to EPA. We have around 12,000 pesticides registered for sale and distribution, and that level looks really high to a lot of people. But if you think of all the disinfectants and sanitizers and all the flea control products, each one of these are counting as separate registrations, whether it's for a 12-pound dog or a 40-pound dog, and so that level looks really inflated. We have around almost 400 of what we call products that are exempt from EPA registration, but we register them in the state, and these are minimal risks. These are like your mint oil, garlic oil, kind of the natural type products. We have 234 of those Section 24C registrations that I spoke of, and around 1,100 pesticide registrants. So we did require some label changes, as Katie Koba, our director, indicated. So after the Wilsonville incident and the three other incidents that happened last year, we had two involving dinotecran and two involving imidacloprid, we required as a condition for 2014 registration, we required that the registrant put one of two label statements on there. One would be, do not apply this product by any application method, which is kind of important, by any application method, to linden, basswood, or other tilia species in the state of Oregon. Or if they wanted to, they could leave out that state of Oregon portion of it and make this prohibition federal. What this did is our review staff actually had to review an additional 150 imidacloprid product labels. That's how many imidacloprid products were required to have that label statement, and 10 dinotefuran products were affected by that. And this is an example. This is actually the product that was used in that Beaverton case that Katie Koba mentioned, that recently there was a tree injection where some trees were treated. Most of the trees were treated in March, and then some of them were treated in May. And this was the product it was treated with, but this is the new label. And they went to their retail market, and they purchased something with the old label. You can see that this new label has the requirement on it. And this one is specific. It says State of Oregon. But if you look at this product, this is also a imidacloprid-containing product. This is something called Merrick, which is fairly widely used. It's a Bayer product. They left out to the state of Oregon, and so they made this prohibition national. And one of the things that they're aware of is that we're in frequent conversation with the state of Washington, and when they heard that we were having the registrants put this restriction on, the state of Washington was kind of maybe interested in doing the same. We mentioned that to the registrant, and there had been some other incidents with imidacloprid in lindens and other states, and so they just thought it was just wise just to prohibit the use on lindens. And so we really highly supported that that decision on their part. Now I'm going to move to EPA's requirements. So all this is happening at the same time, that EPA is asking the registrants, or telling the registrants, that they need to make some changes, and then EPA is saying, yes, and you need to make these changes. So what EPA did is EPA was just focused on foliar applications, where in Oregon we recognize, and I know that EPA recognizes this too, but at least for linden trees, that it wasn't only just a kind of a contact situation where there was a foliar application, because in 2013, there was only one foliar application that happened, and that was the Wilsonville, and the others were either like a basal bark application or soil drench applications. But EPA's label statements are for foliar. So we ended up looking at 113 neonic labels, revised neonic labels. I'll mention another difference. So with the linden trees, we were just focused on dinotecturan and imidacloprid in the state of Oregon. But EPA was interested in four neonics. So it was clothianidin, dinotecturan, thiamethoxin, and imidacloprid. And then EPA also included five other two other insecticides, and that totaled up five different products for us. So they weren't just doing neonics. So the new labels for foliar changes will actually have for non-agriculture products, and this is what we're talking about here as far as our recent incidents with linden, is it would actually have do not apply, and it would insert the name of the product, while bees are foraging, do not apply to plants that are flowering, and only apply after flower petals have fallen off. The ag labels are actually have a lot more extensive language, and I'll go through those briefly. So if you have a crop, and these are, again, just for the four neonics, if you have a crop that's under pollination services, it will state, do not apply while bees are foraging, and do not apply this product until flowering is complete and petals have fallen off, unless, and it has some conditions. And basically, it has you notify the beekeeper, and to say you would have to notify them within 48 hours of the application and the beekeepers to remove those bees. Apparently, this did not set well with a lot of beekeepers when they start seeing this language. And they told EPA, well, you know, that's too short of a period of time for us to get our bees out. We're on the road. We can't go and get them. And so EPA is going to be changing these labels again. And I'll go through the next, and I'll talk very briefly about that. And so if you have a food crop or an ornamental grown or commercially grown ornamental, which would be nursery, that's not under contract for pollination service, but they are attractive to pollinators, again, don't apply while blooming, except if you apply after sunset or the temperatures are below 55 degrees, or if it's in some accordance with some government-issued health response. And then there are a whole bunch of other caveats on the label. And that was another thing that did not set very well with a lot of beekeepers, and I think, George, you probably spoke with EPA. They're familiar with you over there, apparently. And so the labels, once again, will be changed. And in President Obama's memorandum, he talked about some type of pollinator management plan that the federal government will be working with the states to develop. Apparently, that will be showing up on a lot of pesticide labels. There will be a pesticide registration notice that's going to come out this summer from EPA proposing additional changes to these pesticide labels and soliciting for public comment about just how they should change these labels and what might the components be of these pollinator management plans that the states will be following. Oh, and I'll mention one other thing is that there is also a bee advisory box that people or applicators will see on these pesticide labels. And this actually has some really good information in there. And that's it. Any questions?
Yeah. So you showed a couple of images of labels, and then you just at the end showed the bee box along the way.
Yeah.
Is that the way, is that like the first page of those labels, or is that pieces of the label put together for the first two, I guess?
Oh,
and then
boy.
Where is this bee box on the
Right. So there is an environmental hazards box that has some bee statements in it. Then you have, pretty close to the beginning of the label, you'll have the advisory box. And then you'll have some restrictive statements. Then you'll have the restrictions as far as do not apply while flowering. And then sometimes throughout the label, you'll see these bee icons for certain crops. And it will have sometimes even more restrictive statements. And so this is another criticism of the labels, that you have to go to three, four different locations to figure out what to do. And so there is a scattering throughout, and some of the statements are more restrictive than the others, which has caused some confusion among the users as far as which one they should follow. And so EPA is realizing that this needs to.
And the labels that you showed were for a combination of ag use, non-ag use, and homeowner use as well? Or?
Well, the non-ag is the homeowner use.
That's
and that would be,
that? Okay.
You know, even also what you would include on linden trees. And then you have a section of crops that have pollination services, so they have different criteria. And then you have another section of crops that are attractive to but that don't have pollination service, and also commercially grown ornamentals, which would be your nursery crops in that.
Just to, well, you said non-agriculture being homeowner, and I thought it definitely could be confusing to some people if they're not thinking how they're defining agriculture. So I don't know if you want to maybe break it down into a little more detail as to how that, because we stumbled on that a lot in the last, when we were as a stakeholder group.
So let's say somebody went to their local box store, a homeowner went to the local box store, and they looked at a product that had one of these neonics. They would not have all of these different options on there as far as which one of these B statements do I follow. Or they would actually have the non-ag for that particular one. There are labels out there for professionals that will have all three sets of B statements, and then somebody will go through and decide, you know, do I have a pollination service or not? I mean, they can figure that out or not. Or if they're growing a food crop, they know they're growing a food crop. And certainly commercial nursery, they can do that. So I think that it's probably not as confusing as it looks, just because all those statements, for the most part, will not appear on a label that a homeowner would ever look at. That make sense at all?
Yeah. Yeah, sure. So, to just be clear, though, the non-homeowners are getting some information on bees out of the new EPA label.
Yes.
Or non, I'm saying non-homeowners, that's the wrong thing.
Yes. I mean, commercial.
The non-ag. So the homeowners,
and
yes,
commercial.
They are getting for foliar applications.
Right.
Okay. Is it correct that, because some of those labels are sealed in the product, so you're not getting it until you open it at your house. Is that right?
Yes.
You're not getting it at the store. I mean, that's not necessarily my issue. I just wanted to clarify that. Is it?
No.
That's an issue because,
yeah,
you know, agricultural people have to have an applicator's license in most cases, and so they have been educated about issues or could be maybe
right,
even some new issues. But homeowner, the only thing they have is a label. And do they read it or don't they? And do we have any control over that?
And I want to go one step further. What we realized in the stakeholder group was actually a lot of commercial applicators,
yeah,
don't have to be license to apply neonics because they're general use. So they don't necessarily have that training. And how do we get that training to those folks as well?
I think it's in the term you use there. You want to be careful. Mm-hmm. Commercial applicator. If you're a commercial applicator, right. You have to. But you could be somebody who is involved in ag, your ag business, and not have to have one as long as it's on your own land.
You're right. Yes, they... you can define it. It's defined. It can be. You can buy a product that's intended for commercial use, but not for a commercial applicator. So it can be a commercial use product in its general use, and that's a issue that we need to figure out how to get that training to those.
I didn't hear what you said, Jeff.
We found during this exercise that there were far more folks who. May not have an applicator license, but they use this particular chemical class because it is relatively safe for human use to apply it. It's relatively simple. It's very effective. And the level of outreach that the nursery industry did to its members was significant about be smart about how you apply this because our industry is dependent on it. I think these are all great points. My suggestion to the chair is that we make this the list of all the things that we really want to try to dig down deep in, because at first when I was talking with Representative Reardon, we were talking about whether or not, you know, how do you get at the homeowner side, but the number of folks in the ag were far greater than I even understood at the time. So there are always trade-offs. So I think when we're looking at, especially particularly the neonicotinoid issue, if we choose to focus on that I'm not saying what the group should do. If we're going to choose to do that, we should look at what the trade-offs are to both human health and effectiveness and all those other things. Does that make sense?
Fine.
Well, unless we're not talking about removing products, but talking about changing how things are used and ways they're used, which isn't necessarily then an either or. It's not, do we use acephate or do we use, it's a different discussion.
With the permission of the chair, could I butt in?
Yeah, absolutely.
I've got some ideas about how we get there, because this won't be our last meeting, obviously.
Right.
So, Rose, thank you so much for laying the groundwork for us. And we only have 16 minutes. So, dedicated chair, non-chair that I am, I've been working really hard on this. So let's pass this.
I have a question for Rose. Hey, Rose, do you also do like core trainings? Who sets those classes up and things like that?
Yes, we're heavily involved with training, and pollinator protection would be considered a core training.
So that's in your core training now, or it's going to be? Okay, good. And then they get, if you're an applicator, a commercial applicator, you get that training every how many years?
If you were a private applicator, then you would only need 16 credits within a five-year period. If you're a commercial applicator, then you need 40 credits within a five-year period.
And everybody's required to take core training?
No, just private applicators.
Well, that's right, private commercial?
Commercial are not required to do four.
But they have other classes.
They have a lot more course requirements.
Okay.
So I actually was slated to talk also about licensing, but because of the incident. So if you want to invite me, I'll be attending. If you want me to talk more extensively about
let's plan on it.
Yeah.
And I'm so sorry. This is just, I feel so compressed for time, but I think it's really, this has been two very excellent presentation to kind of, looking at the health, looking at our current state of regulation and licensing and all of that. I think the question is, what can we do in this group? We have Obama is throwing $50 million at the effort. So, but what can we do in this group fairly quickly to help improve the health of pollinators? It's pretty simple. And we went through in our prior meetings, we went through and kind of talked about some things that we would do in this task force. And I'd like to walk you through this because this is a blend of what the stakeholder group came up with, and that's shown in the bold and as bill language. And just some kind of thoughts that I had to try to get this focused on something that we can do. And I think there should be extra copies of these.
We're getting more copies.
Okay,
I've
thank
some
you.
More.
There's a couple here.
Okay.
But we need to really help focus this group, and I really love the some of the questions have come up. It sounds like our thinking actually might be quite.
Can I ask a question just to help me think about this?
Yep.
How I know our deadline is October 1st to get the report done, which is one day before my due date. Let's stick to that. but then I also wanted to just see if how many times we're planning on meeting, just to kind of understand this. I can see the scope, but like into what time frame or meeting timeline are we trying to squeeze it into?
So it's always hard, you know, what are we talking about versus the timeline. So the timeline is excellent. We can meet through, we want to have a report of some kind done by, like I said, October 1st. We can continue to meet beyond that if we wish. And so that's part of it. I know my schedule is horrible. Beth has talked a little bit about perhaps a total of four meetings, I believe, is what you thought.
That's what we initially talked
before
about.
Before October 1st.
So
yeah.
Hopefully no more than that. So and what I'd like to do is kind of focus on what we might be, what goal or overall goal might be, what we hope to accomplish, and then have to find out what information everybody is excited about discussing in the future, who can bring what to the table, who's willing to do more research, and that sort of thing. Some of that discussion may happen afterwards. I think Beth will be contacting you, but in the limited time we have available, if we could kind of focus on what we want to get accomplished, and then Beth and her wisdom and skill will get it all coordinated. Does that make sense? Okay, so let's just go through this real quick. We had items 1 and 2, 3, evaluating effectiveness of applicator license and other legal requirements. I'm just going to keep going. Evaluating existing best management practices. Maybe there's things that are being done in other states that aren't being done here. I know there's some integrated pest management systems out there. What are they? Who uses those? Who's required? I think City of Eugene has done some work. Are there integrated pest management system or information that could maybe be cloned in some way that it gets out to that home user and in a form of better information for them? A little bit specifically about how chemicals are used in nurseries or large farms, or what else they do to control pests, maybe before even using pesticides. So, number 5, studying proposed and enacted pesticide regulations from other states and countries that are more protective of pollinator health than the pesticide regulations of the U.S. So is there federal legislation? So we've already heard that there's work that's underway. Are there any corporate programs that are going on that would help us? And any nonprofits, advocate programs, so be an opportunity maybe for Xerces Society or other pollinator or protection organizations to step in and provide some information about how they're helping protect pollinators. Number 6 is just threw that in there. We didn't talk about it specifically, but the habitat is one of the things that came up in Ramesh's presentation, that there may be an issue with providing good nutrition for the bees, and is perhaps part of that the habitat. Have they lost habitat? Is there ways to expand the amount of habitat that's available to bees? Okay, number seven, looking at public education outreach plans regarding pollinator health. We know we have a great extension service. We have what other ways are there to get information out? Talking to probably most everybody, I think, we realize that just having information for the home gardener that are just relying on that label, we don't know whether they're reading it. We don't know whether whether the labels are very adequate. I think we've got some opportunities there. There seems to be a wealth of information that we don't have about home users, and yet they're using some of the same products. Some of their products are actually recommended on their labels at a higher rate than what the agricultural users are using. So I think there's a lot of opportunity for working with the general public and providing their information. And to that end, I've listed some things here. Pardon me, but I've got a marketing background. And so that's what 7.1 through 7.4 is talking about, is what kind of information systems are there? Are there things then other than a label? Any apps for that? Are there any apps out there that tell people, this is a linden tree, and this is what you don't spray on it? If there are systems, how are they kept current? That's a major issue. We've got new products coming out all the time. How is the information system paid for? Is it through grants? Is it through the largesse of the corporations? I don't know. Do we need some fees? Pesticide product distribution and marketing. Thinking of Betsy on 7.4 is, what are some of the markets? Can we get a breakdown specifically on what are the markets? How are the products distributed? How are they promoted? How are the clerks at Wilco trained or Home Depot? How many customers by market segment? I have no clue right now personally where are the pesticides going and in what volumes? So if we look at home users, are they buying 10% and everything else is going to ag community or commercial sprayers? I don't know. And I don't know if anybody has that.
I'll look that out.
Okay.
And see what we know, at least as far as retailers.
Yeah, that would be extremely helpful.
May not know, but I'll see.
And then 8 is back to the funding streams. How do we pay for some of this? If we come up with some great ideas, whatever those ideas are, how are they paid for? So corporations, states, grants, I don't know. But there's some opportunities there. So if we do all of that, because that's what we talked about as a stakeholder group, plus or minus a little bit, are we going to be able to come up with recommendations? So we know that we're going to have some kind of a report at the end of this. Hopefully that's information that we've gotten from all of you that contributes to this report. Hopefully it's information we all agree on, and we can say, hey, this is good. Other people can use this information. They know it's helpful. Is there other outcomes that you might have in mind for this?
Are you asking a question?
I think I am.
I have lots of ideas.
What are we doing here?
The extension publication that Ramesh 591 recently updated, but even since that, it was 5 years before the last time, but even since it's been published, there are new materials which are now out there, and they're not in there. And it doesn't have an application for smartphones and stuff like that. There would be some cost involved, but that's really a great tool. But if it's incomplete, then we're missing something. So I don't know. There is cost involved with that, but it seems to me that we ought to explore, at least recommend, that thing be made current on a regular basis, and that we might explore an app.
How do we keep the information current?
Yep.
Whatever that information system is. So great.
And it fits with 4.2 under best management practices. In many ways, that's what that
I think we talked about that, George, and it's a little challenging because there is a product coming out like every day probably sometimes, and it's basically we need to get from ODA probably. I don't know. Rose, do you think that's possible? Can we get information on new products that come in every 6 months or 5 months, whatever? New labels or new active ingredients. So what George is saying in that 591, we don't have all the information for the new products that come in. There was a new recent addition, right? George, what was that you were talking about? The recent product that came out from DuPont or something?
Someone was telling me this one, and it's not in there.
Exerel,
yeah.
I think that's the point is, let's just say that, I'll get crazy here. Let's just say that everybody in this room decided that banning neonics was a great idea. Okay? I'm not saying that's going to happen. Just saying that in that scenario. Okay? And what's next? What do we know for sure would happen if neonics were put on a restricted use list? What do we know for sure would happen?
Yeah, I
want to answer the question. What do you know would happen next?
Well, I think it depends on, we're looking at hundreds of crops and tons of application methods. Some of the time, there's a lot of prophylactic use, and some of the time we might not need to supplement with anything. Other times they're going to switch to other products.
So you're talking about how it's used. But I'm saying that if neonics goes away, do you think there's going to be son of neonic coming along?
At some point, but there's also father of neonic.
Absolutely.
I guess.
Yeah. Absolutely. Point is, are we going to be living with pesticides for some time to come? That's very likely, right? So what can we do? I think I keep coming back to the question of what can we do to recognize there is a need for better information distribution, helping people make the right decisions about whether or not to use a pesticide, and if they do, can we help them use it correctly? I just can't make it any harder than that.
I think that's very reasonable. Yeah, I mean, I would say education is more important. You know, and there are some ways probably they don't need to even use those kind of insecticides because they're easily available now. So some of the folks might be using those. But, yeah, I think by education, I think that makes a huge difference. I would say outreach is very important, especially for the homeowners and those kind of people. You know, just
so when we look at best management practices and pest management systems and all of that, that's, to me, that's probably where you start with that education, is what can you do before you run down to Home Depot and even look at what's on that shelf. So
I definitely love, I think that the education and the outreach is super beneficial to our licensed applicators. And that's why we weighed in on that, and it was so wonderful last session that we moved to get more education. I think that when we talk about homeowners, if you look at behavior change, it's going to be a really long, slow, and I'm not as sure. I think, you know, you hit on a really good point a minute ago, and you said, right now, our labels allow more to be used in a backyard than in ag. You look at an apple tree in a backyard, depending on how you break it down, because it's hard to compare, at a minimum, you're looking at 12 times more of some of these products, of these active ingredients, being allowed in a backyard than in an ag field on that same apple tree. And so yeah. I think in the backyard, I think we can make some change, and I don't think, I'm afraid that it's outreach alone isn't going to be enough. I think I want to get to your crowd more. I want to make sure they've got good information coming from the state. And I think that education has a lot to do with that. But I'm really cautious on our backyard to think that education is going to really get the change.
And I don't want to limit it necessarily, educating the backyard folks alone. But there's, and that's why I broke it out this way. Who are the different classes of users? What's their information stream? That's why I wanted to ask Betsy for information about, you know, what is the flow of that product and how is information distributed, and take a look at that. So that's...
The retailers are doing a good job putting information out too. I know you, I'm trying to think some of the...
Well, I know right now that Wilco is taking steps based on what, with the new rule that came out from ODA about putting some shelf talkers out and doing some things like that. especially, I mean, in all of their environments, but they've definitely got that kind of retail side now that's becoming a little bit bigger. That gets a lot of the backyard people, and they're putting that information out there as well. I know they've been stepping up to do that.
And let me caution you that I don't know if they track things that way. Right. The big box is where a lot of that goes through, but I'll definitely find out.
We're just about out of time, but
I just want to make one thing I saw that it looks like they're doing at the federal level, which I think is important. Commercial or my applicator life pesticide license compared to the homeowner is that if it is toxic to bees, we get that on the product, and it looks like they're kind of changing that label to where it'll be on the product. Because when you start going into the label as the homeowner buys it, I was putting on, I think, some stuff for my wife the other day. And, you know, everybody that does that is in a hurry. So you go right to the label and you go through to say, because you want to see how much per gallon. That's what you look at. So I think if the label, if it is harmful to bees, that's on the outside of the label and with their insignia of the bee thing. So people, when they see it on the shelf, go, oh, this, they don't have to dig through the little and get the little directions out in order to see it. I think that, but it sounds like the folks at the federal level are thinking about that already. So some of the things we're going to do in this group, there is a group at the federal level looking at these things too. So we don't want to spend a lot of time doing the same thing they're doing. Yeah.
So one of the things that I, in here, you kind of touched on it, is it seems to me, and this is anecdotal, because, I mean, Wilco's doing some stuff, but farmers and users of these pesticides get their advice from a lot of different places. Might be from the booklet, but it might be from a crop advisor, it might be from a salesman. And my impression is that many of these people are not educated in pollinator protection. They're salespeople. And they may understand pest control, but they don't understand pollinator protection. And so I don't know how many times in my lifetime as a beekeeper I've been faced with the advice from a crop advisor or a pesticide salesman to a farmer to do something that was unwise or impossible from my standpoint. And so I just wonder if maybe that isn't a component, that these people, they're not really licensed applicators. They're not, you know, they're the people that are, but they're the people who are giving advice. And so that broad group of people, I think, need to be, and I think that, like Wilco and others have told me, Syngenta representative told me that they're doing it and so forth, but I'm not too sure that we're getting to all of them because it's still happening, bad advice being given.
So I should mention that if they are making recommendations on restricted use pesticides, then they actually have to be but if somebody is just providing advice on general use pesticides, which
I need to excuse myself. I have a meeting. I need to be in Portland at 2:00 for a meeting, and so Beth is going. Would like to first of all collect your volunteerism. So if you're volunteering to sign up for any of these things, could you get that information from them? And then she's going to work with me to come up with a health plan, a work plan. And so you'll be hearing from Beth in the next few days about what the next steps are. But I feel like we've really got quite a high level of consensus here, that we have some opportunities, and we have a lot to share yet. But I think it's a really good start.
Yeah. We'll also decide on the next meeting as well today.
Yeah, but can you guys do that without me?
Yeah, he has your dates right.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry, So are you going to do that now?
Yeah, sure.
Right. Dates?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, generally, let's find a general time frame, and then I'll do a poll, and we'll do it that way. Should be easier. You leaving all your cherries? I guess so. So next meeting, if he said it, I missed it. He was, Rudin is asking that if there are parts of this that you're particularly interested in working on, Betsy offered to be looking into the retailers to let me know that. That would be helpful.
If you don't need that sheet, you could just put your initials on.
You could do that or just email me.
Or just email.
Whatever you want to do is fine with me.
Thank you.
Sure. And then in terms of next meeting dates, I was just going to try to find a date sometime in the next 2 to 3 weeks that we could meet again. And we are a little bit restricted in terms of location just because the meetings have to be recorded and we have to take all this stuff with if we go anywhere else. So if there's a need to meet someplace else, we can do that. But if we can just meet here, that's simplest logistically for us. But we can do it if we need to meet someplace else. In terms of meeting dates, does anybody have any thoughts about time frame that I should be thinking about when I send out a poll, or can we just...
Maybe you guys need some time to think about these things as well, right? So you should try to get some information on these, and maybe it takes at least a couple of weeks to go through these. So maybe like last week of July,
third week of July.
Yeah, I would urge setting dates. Summer is going to be is going to be a nightmare anyway.
I think what I'll try to do is set all of the meeting dates from now until October 1st in one shot, so we can just everybody can get it on their calendar. Okay, all right.
I think we'd need, if we're going to have four meetings, we should have three of them in July and August, and then maybe one just to finalize the document and hash out any controversies or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so every 3 weeks between now and September 1st and 1 sometime with it. I'm left to make changes.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay, I'll look at that and see how that works out and send out a poll to everybody. And then, in terms of the rest of it, what I was going to try to do was put together basically a skeleton of a work plan for the group, lay out the issues that Rep. Rudin has identified that are in the bill, and then hopefully at the next meeting, I'll just put something down for you all to take a shot at, and then we can work through it and decide what the group wants to do.
The only thing I saw missing on here that I didn't want to get in the way of Representative Reardon's need to leave, but I don't know where research fits in here, the aggregation of research. I think it's implicit in a couple of these, but I'd probably call it out.
There's some funding streams, the number 8, I guess, but yeah, it's kind of not so clear, I guess. Yeah. So you want to add that one, research needs?
I think it would be good to. I found out this week that just today that I was George Hansen's replacement in front of the House Agriculture Committee.
Oh.
And so I'd urge this group to do the same thing that I urge Congress to do, is to be an aggregating force for research, and that we should have a pretty wide array of different types of narratives to then try to find where this group kind of is their center line. If I'm going to urge it of Congress, I should, and I don't have any faith that they'll do anything, but they were very receptive. That was a great committee. But I have more faith in this group, and in fact, I'm happy to share my testimony that I gave them in that, because I talk about the effort in Oregon being an example. I'll be quiet.
Anybody else have anything?
They're broad enough that a lot of things fit under them, it feels like. So I think, yeah. All of the crazy little details that swim in my head will easily fit under.
Yeah, and if you have, after this meeting today, any thoughts you have, just as I'm working on the work plan, I'd appreciate.
Thank you.
Give me a call, send me an email.
I'll give this back to you.
Well, I know, I've cataloged a lot of the stuff that's happening in other places as far as research into other states, so I can get a lot of that to you.
But you can ask via email, right, who is interested in this different thing.
Yeah, I'm going to have missed things, so there's going to be other stuff.
Okay. You want me to hit this thing?
Yes, please.
No. Thank you very much. We conclude the meeting.